And now, wings.
Good evening. I'm June Millington, and on behalf of IMA, I'd like to welcome you to tonight's performance. It's my pleasure to present Carolyn Gage in her award-winning one-woman show, The Second Coming of Joan of Arc.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. The Second Coming of Joan of Arc, written and performed by Carolyn Gage.
Okay. Here's Compin over here. It's ours. And there's Marnie over there. Now that belongs to the Duke of Burgundy's men. Those are the French who are fighting for the English king, you know, the enemy. And here's the river in the middle. And over this river is a bridge, right from Compiègne to Marny, and this bridge is unguarded. All we have to do is cross over, surprise them, and Marny's ours. Nothing to it, right? And that's what we did do. We cross, we attack, they're retreating, and then suddenly, off over here, we see more of the Duke of Burgundy's men coming from the next town across the way. Well, I mean, that's not good news, but it's not the end of the world either. I say to myself, okay, this is going to take a little longer than I thought. But my soldiers, they see these reinforcements, you know what they do? They lose it. They take off running back across the bridge to Compiègne, and I'm yelling at them, and I'm trying to get them to stand and fight, but there's no way to stop them. Did you ever try to stop a scared man? So, I do the next best thing. I stay behind, and I cover the retreat. So here I am, on my horse, fighting backwards to get across the bridge. The entire army is streaming past me, and suddenly I hear this terrible noise. It is the worst noise in the world. You know what that is? That is the sound that the drawbridge at Compiègne makes when it's being raised by my own men. So, here I am. Cut off, surrounded by enemy soldiers. Yeah, I'm captured. I think the word is ditched. You know, when you're locked in a cell for 8 months with nothing to do, you have a lot of time to ask yourself questions. Questions like, why in the hell didn't they wait to raise that lousy drawbridge? Don't tell me they didn't know where I was. I mean, the entire army had to run past me on the bridge to Compiègne. Don't tell me they thought I could take care of myself, me against 500 enemy soldiers. I mean, come on, what were they thinking? You know what I decided? I decided they weren't thinking anything, which in itself is a statement. They were scared, they were in a hurry, they saw me fighting on the bridge, and they did not think about it. They did not think about what was going to happen to me if they raised that drawbridge. It was irrelevant. Now, there is a term for the chapters on women in your high school history books. Non-essential information. In the brains of these men, the textbook of their personal history has two essential chapters, one on fraternity and one on chivalry. Now, the chapter on fraternity tells them how to act around other men, how to be a team player, loyal comrade, an esteemed colleague, how to close ranks against outsiders, and never, ever, under any circumstances, to desert a brother officer in the heat of battle. Now, the chapter on chivalry tells them if they are on a sinking ship, they should make sure that the women and children are saved first. The problem was, I was neither a brother nor a helpless female. In the brains of these men, the section on me was just an insert, you know, with a border of little cannons around it and the heading in flowery letters, Maid of Orléans. It was non-essential information. They would not be held responsible for it during a test. So with the enemy bearing down on them, they stuck to the essentials. The image of me fighting on the bridge was entered into their program for fraternity, chivalry, nothing turned up, so they raised the drawbridge. Now, in case you're thinking this kind of thing only happens to butch women, I say look again. I submit that every one of you is an insert
in the textbook of your country. I look out over this sea of non-essential faces, and I can see the little borders around your lives, individually and collectively. Your inserts in the lives of men, your inserts in the history of your nation, your inserts in the roll books of your government. And when it comes down to the real issues, we are all going to be missing from the program. Now, what I'm here for tonight is to take the border off Saint Joan of Arc and to put my life back in the main text. My story is not a sideline of history, some piece of local color, optional reading. My story is the story of all women, and my suffering is identical to yours. My trial was the trial of all women. My misguided crusade, it's all of our misguided crusades. My enemies, they're your enemies. My mistakes, they're your mistakes. The voices I hear, they're your voices. And the voices that you hear, they're my voices. In the first place, my name is not Joan. It's Jean. Well, how did Jean get to be Joan? Well, it got lost in the translation. In 500 years, a lot of things about my life got lost in the translation. In the second place, of Arc makes it sound like I come from some town called Arc. I don't. I come from Domremy. There is no such place as Arc. It's a poor translation of my father's name. And besides that, I never used his name. I went by my mother's name, Romay. And in the third place, I never gave anybody permission to make me a saint. I mean, think about it. The same boys who burned me at the stake want to turn around and make me a public relations officer for their church. Right. Over my dead body. So my name is not Saint Joan of Arc. It's Jean Romay. Big deal, right? Who cares? I care. Because Joan of Arc is not my name, and saint is just another word for a woman who got burned. And it's time we stop letting other people change our names, and it's time we stop believing it's some kind of honor to be tortured by men. And most of all, it is time that we started telling the truth about our own lives, because these myths are killing us. So, soldier, martyr, hero, saint, all between the ages of 17 and 19. That is when I died, 19. I just had those 2 years. Soldier, martyr, hero, saint, idiot. It was my death that did it. The beautiful peasant girl clutching a makeshift cross, eyes lifted up to heaven as she disappears in a cloud of fiery smoke. That was the death of Saint Joan of Arc. Tonight, I want to tell you how Jean Romay died. The beginning of the end was Easter Day, 1430. I was all of 18. The city of Melun had just surrendered to me, which was very exciting because it had belonged to the English for 10 years. I was standing on the walls of the city, and the people and the soldiers were all cheering for me, and the bells of the church were ringing. I couldn't have been happier. The king had been crowned. I was a national hero. Everything was possible. And then I heard my voices. And my voices. Everybody always wants to know about my voices. When do I hear them? What do they sound like? Do other people hear them too? Oh, and here's my favorite question from the English. So, how come they always speak to you in French? Oh, my voices. My voices aren't all that special. Everybody hears voices. Everybody's got somebody leaning over their shoulder, whispering in their ear what they should do, what they shouldn't do. You know, get the hair out of your face, put your knees together. That's what civilization's about, isn't it? Listening to the voices of those who lived before we did. That's what keeps the whole machinery going. Now, the real problem for civilization comes when a woman decides to invent her own voices and then believe in them. You see, that's almost like thinking for yourself. You're surprised to hear me say I invented my voices? Well, let's just put it this way. I heard what I believed as much as I believed what I heard. I mean, come on.
Where is the reality in the voices that you hear? Is it out there somewhere, or do you make them real for yourself? Just where does the authority come from?
Come on, we all invent our voices.
Mine were just a little more blatantly fictional, that's all. And that's because I did not like the selection available to young women in Domremy. Here's my father's voice. Jean, a rich young man will come and you will go and marry him and he will help your poor old father take care of his sheep. And then there's my mother's voice. Jean, a nice young man will come along and you will go and marry him and have lots and lots of babies and then you'll understand exactly how I feel. And let's not forget the priest. Jean, God has called you to give yourself to him and you will go and enter a convent and say prayers all day long that things will get better. I mean, all the voices in Domremy were more or less variations on these themes. But then, one day, I'm walking in my father's garden and I hear this voice. Jean, you have been chosen by God to ride at the head of the army, to take the king to be crowned, and to drive the English out of France. Yeah. Now that's what I call a voice. That was the voice of St. Michael, and I liked it so much, a few days later, I heard St. Catherine and St. Margaret. Why saints? Why these particular saints? Well, now, you have to remember, Domremy was a pretty small place, and good role models were hard to come by. I mean, outside your family and your neighbors, you're pretty much looking at the sheep. If I wanted another point of reference, I was going to have to use my imagination. And I did. There was a statue of St. Margaret in our church, and there was one of St. Catherine in the church across the river, and everybody knew who St. Michael was because he was the patron saint of the district. So not too surprisingly, these were my role models, my voices. Now let me tell you about them. Well, there was St. Michael. Now, he led an army of angels out to do battle with Satan and kicked him out of heaven. He was our Catholic cowboy, our superhero saint. He always wore full armor and he carried a sword. Then there was St. Catherine. Now, she was arrested and put on trial for her religious beliefs, and 50 old men sat around and asked her a lot of trick questions, but she outsmarted them all, which turned out not to be so smart because it made her sexually irresistible to the emperor who had had her arrested in the first place. And, of course, when she turned him down, he had to do something to save face, so he cut off her head. Then there's St. Margaret. Now, I think you're going to like her. She ran away the night she was supposed to get married, and she cut her hair very, very short, and she passed herself off as a monk for a number of years. And this worked out fine until some woman came along and accused her of getting her pregnant. Hey, go Margaret. But Margaret decided that it was better to spend the rest of her life in solitary confinement than to admit that she was a woman. But they found out she was anyway and cut off her head. Some role models, right? Michael, Catherine, Margaret. Guess what? I grew up to lead an army, dress like a man, and to stand trial for my religious beliefs. No, my life was not original at all. I copied my role models as faithfully as any one of you copied yours. Mine were just a little more flamboyant. You know, we have got to stop and take a look at our role models. Like, maybe spend 2 minutes thinking about the people we're going to spend the next 40 years imitating. Look, take me, for instance. I had two female martyrs, both beheaded, and one male conquering hero. Now, you know what I should have noticed is the only happy ending was the man's. What I also should have noticed is that a conquering male gets an entirely different reception than a conquering female. That is because the only thing a woman is expected to defeat is herself. Anything else is not considered victory, but castration. I mean, what I'm saying is I should have noticed that I had a third act that was not going to work because the lead role was written for a man. What? And I mean, what is the happy ending for women? Is it marriage when the whole company comes out on stage and joins hands around the happy couple while they ring down the curtain? And they better ring down the curtain because, as we all know, this is the point where the leading lady retires from the stage. Or is the happy ending for women those scenes when the fatally wounded or terminally ill heroine sings her dying aria in the arms of her broken-hearted lover? I mean, the bad news is she dies, but the good news is he really did love her after all. Too little, too late, who's keeping score? I mean, is there some happy ending for women that does not require our total spiritual annihilation? What if we just dropped everything? I mean, whatever we've got going, what if we just stopped until we could figure out what that happy ending is, and not just figure it out, but see it, feel it, touch it, taste it? Because I'm here to tell you, you are going to paint what you're looking at. And if we don't start coming up with something better than these martyred female saints, we're all going to end up at the stake. You know, you women are allowed to go out and work in the man's world today. When I did it in 1430, I was a real freak. But let me tell you something. The men haven't changed, the rules haven't changed, and the institutions haven't changed. And the fact that there are more of you doing it just means they're getting ready to build a bigger fire. So, getting back to my voices. First time I heard them, I was 13. It's a good age for internalizing voices, isn't it? The age of puberty. Puberty. I already knew what puberty was even before I got there, because I'd figured out it must be the missing link in the story of my mother's life. Isabella Rome was my mother. Now, I didn't see too much of her, even though I spent 17 years under the same roof with her, if you know what I mean. By the time I was born, she'd already had 3 kids and spent more than half her life married. And when she opened her mouth, it was wife talk or mother talk. The only time I ever heard Isabella speak with her own voice was when she'd tell us kids about her trip to Rome. You see, when she was a little girl, her family had gone on a pilgrimage to see the Pope, and they'd taken her with her. And this was a big adventure for them. Traveling all that way, going into a foreign country, staying somewhere different every night, meeting all kinds of people from all kinds of places. And whenever she would tell us these stories, she'd get very animated and her eyes would shine, and she would literally turn into somebody else. Somebody I didn't know. Somebody who'd never had kids. Somebody who'd lived a whole other life in a whole other world. And this person who'd had all these big adventures and wanted to go back, and who was brave and independent and funny, well, she was not my mother. And the only thing I could figure out was that something terrible, and I mean really terrible, must have happened to turn this little girl with all the big adventures into this woman who was going to be doing exactly the same thing tomorrow that she did yesterday. And I didn't know what this terrible thing was until I saw it happen to my big sister. In 1 year, she went from being full of crazy ideas and lots of fun to being serious and boring and busy. Now, that terrible thing was puberty, and I made up my mind it was never going to happen to me. Puberty. That's the beginning of breasts, which means you can nurse babies. That's the beginning of periods, which means you can have babies. That's the beginning of feeling self-conscious around boys, because you have this opening between your legs they all want to stick themselves into. Puberty is about loss of privacy. Puberty is about living in a body that suddenly become public property. Puberty is about foreign invasion, occupied territory. One by one, my girlfriends surrendered. I watched them go off with boys and turn themselves into foreigners. Charlotte, Mangette, even my best friend Oviette. At least that's what I thought at the time. That's a whole other story. Anyway, every day I could feel my family, my neighbors, and my relatives laying siege to me. They surrounded me and they would not let anything in or out which would allow me to have a life of my own. They were isolating me, trying to starve the spirit out of me, waiting for little Jean to raise the white flag and throw open her gates. And then they were going to pour into my citadel. They would murder my warriors, take my children hostage, rape my women, seize anything of value, destroy whatever they couldn't use. And then when they were thoroughly in control of what little life I had left, then they would feed me. Let me tell you a secret. They can't threaten you with starvation if you learn not to eat. That's right. And that's what I did. I would eat as little as possible. One piece of bread a day. And it worked. My body stayed the body of a young girl. When I died at 19, I had still never menstruated. I had found a way to avoid puberty. I love my body, my lean body, somewhere between men and women, somewhere where nobody can catch me. I was a freak. There's a lot of pain in being a freak, but there's a lot of respect. People have got to deal with you on your own terms. They cannot project their fantasies on you. I was a freak, I still am. Let me tell you something. There is no such thing as eating disorders in a prison camp. There are only eating strategies. And mine was very successful. I did not die by millimeters, as if it was my own fault. I did not fall into the same trap that my mother and my sisters did. If I wasn't getting enough of the things to keep me alive, I was going to look like it. I was going to make the killers come out and show themselves. And they did. I'm getting ahead of myself. My father had a dream about me. I'm sure he had a lot of dreams about me, but this is the only one I ever heard about. In this particular fantasy, or dream as he called it, he saw me leaving home to go off with a group of soldiers. In his infinite masculine wisdom and his alcoholic omniscience, he took this to be an omen that I was headed for a life of prostitution. Fascinating interpretation, don't you think, for a man to have about his own daughter? It might have put his mind at ease to know that my military calling was not based on an attraction to men, but on my desire to kill them. Then again, it might not. Anyway, this dream had become a problem for him. You might even say he had become obsessed by it. I mean, he tried all the standard remedial methods of battering me and calling me a slut, but you know, in spite of all his best efforts, I just could not seem to keep myself from reminding him of a prostitute. So when I was 17, he engaged me to a nice young man. I said I had no intentions of getting married, so the nice young man threatened to take me to court. I said, hey, go ahead. It's my father's promise, not mine. He thought he could call my bluff, but I called his. We went to court, and I won. Of course, I made a fool out of my father, and life at home was pure hell after that. Then the enemy soldiers came through Domremy and they burned everything they could get their hands on. So that was a real red letter year for me, the year I was 17. My whole family turned against me. The town where I'd lived my whole life was burned to the ground. But these were just brush fires compared to the real catastrophe. That same year, my best friend, Oviette, she got engaged. That did it. France's hour of glory had struck. I ran away from home. The hardest part of running away was leaving my mother. It's like in battle when the soldier next to you gets his legs blown off by a cannon. You don't want to leave him, but there's nothing you can do for him. And if you stay, they're just going to get you too. So you leave. Like I left my mother. But it tore my heart out. The last year before I left, she was always telling me to get married and quit making so much trouble for my father. But you know something? Underneath all those layers of wife and mother, way in the back of her eyes, I could still see the embers of that trip to Rome smoldering in her memory like the remnants of some sacred fire from the altar of her lost girlhood. And I wanted to take those embers and fan them back into flame. And then I wanted to take my life, to live out my life, my whole life, not just one or two episodes, in the blaze of that hot, bright fire. I left my mother without telling her I was going, but I felt and I still feel I have her blessings. I rode out with the standard of my mother's lost girlhood. I am the champion of lost girlhood dreams. After I left home, I went to stay with my cousin. His wife was expecting a baby and she needed some help, but I didn't stay there long. I talked my cousin into taking me to see the governor of the fort at Vaucouleurs.
I wanted this man to give me a military escort to Chinon where I could see the king. Well, the first time we went, things didn't go so well. In fact, they didn't go at all. The governor took one look at me and he started laughing. He told my cousin he better take me back home or else he was going to turn his soldiers loose on me. Big joke, right? So I went back with my cousin. I went back and I thought about what had happened. And the more I thought about things, the more I kept seeing this big, red, long, hot, heavy wool dress. The dress I'd been wearing. The dress I always wore. The dress that every other woman from my village had always worn. And the more I thought about this big, red, long, hot, heavy wool dress, the more I began to see things the way the governor had. You see, that dress had a voice. In fact, that dress spoke louder than I did. Even before I opened my mouth, that dress had already introduced me. Hi. You don't know me, but I'm someone who chooses to wear this thing that's uncomfortable, impractical, and unsafe. I'm someone who chooses to wear this thing that won't let me run, fight, ride a horse, swim, that won't even let me walk outside without falling over unless I have both hands free so I can hold my skirts up. Hi, you don't know me, but I'm someone who chooses to wear this thing that makes rape very, very easy for men, even though I know they'll rape any chance they get. I really don't want that to happen. So what about it, big boy? Think you can take me seriously wearing this garment you wouldn't be caught dead in? Yeah, right. So when I went back to see the governor, I wore real clothes, like the kind men get to wear. And what a surprise. This time he let me talk. You know, there's a lot of myths and theories about why this macho governor gave me, a young female nobody, that military escort. Some people say, well, she must have convinced him with a supernatural prophecy. Or others say, well, he believed this legend that a woman was going to save France. Or somebody talked him into it. And this is my personal favorite. He was just desperate enough to try anything. But the truth is, there is no man on earth who can stand in the way of a woman who is utterly convinced of the rightness of her actions. So, since we women are usually right, why are we still stuck in the Dark Ages? Because we don't feel like we're right. Well, if we are right, why don't we feel like it? Because we are waiting for permission. Now, you will notice that my career began to slide after the king had been crowned and I started needing his permission. Before that, nothing could stop me in my voices. But after I started waiting for permission, I lost my timing, I lost my momentum, and finally, I lost my confidence.
Author and actor Carolyn Gage. Her website is carolyngage.com. That's CarolynGage, carolyngage.com. Tune in next week for more of The Second Coming of Joan of Arc. Special thanks to CJSF-FM and to your local radio station, to Suzette Cullen and to Genevieve Vaughn, editor of Il Dono, The Gift. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden, and this is Wings, the Women's International News Gathering Service.